Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. I'm having some really good tea right now. I'm having some turmeric and blueberry powder, and then also some macadamia nut milk and some 100% dark chocolate. So I take a little piece of dark chocolate, drop it into the macadamia nut milk, which is unsweetened. The dark chocolate is 100%, so it's also very bitter and unsweetened. And then mix in some fermented turmeric powder from New Chapter, and then also a teaspoon of organic blueberry powder. And so this, as you can imagine, the chocolate and the blueberry and the turmeric, this is like a great little afternoon pick-me-up slash brain boost. You get a little bit of caffeine too in the 100% chocolate. Don't know why I'm telling you that, but it's a tasty drink. Today's show is awesome. My old friend Tim Ferriss, it's been a while since we've done a podcast together, so it's good to reconnect with him and talk about his new book. It's called Tribe of Mentors. Really fun read. I was lucky enough to get an early copy, and it's one of those choose your own adventure books that you can just jump around and learn a lot. We'll talk about that book, some of his favorite tidbits out of that book. Also, a little bit later in the episode, if you stick around, we start talking about Tim's supplements and how that's changed over time, what he takes today. He's doing some crazy stuff where he's shooting himself up with, not shooting himself up, he's doing like an IV drip of this stuff called NAD, which I've also been playing around with for a couple months. I have done the oral version of that. I haven't done the full IV, which is a little hardcore, but we'll talk about that. And then also, you know, one of the things that I really enjoyed from this episode is we talk about the one question that Tim asks himself every single day, and how that question helps frame all the things that he gets involved with and that he does. So great episode. But before we get into that, let's talk about my newsletter. You can sign up for it over at thejournal.email. It is just once a month. It is what I call the newsletter for the curious. When I send it, I pack it full of my favorite articles, products, videos, documentaries, weird Japanese stuff. You never know what you're going to get. Sent just once a month. Join 90,000 other folks and sign up over at thejournal.email. Without further ado, here is Mr. Tim Ferriss. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kev. I'm glad to be engaging with you telephonically.
It's weird that, I mean, obviously I've been on your show, we've done shows together, but you've never been on my show.
I haven't.
No, you've been on Foundation.
Have I?
Weren't you on Foundation?
I could have been. I think my early onset Alzheimer's makes it hard to remember sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know either. There was like, I haven't done that show in a few years, so I'll have to go back and look. Dude, I want to talk about your new book. This is exciting. You've got yet another book dropping here in what? Just like a couple weeks, huh?
Just in a couple weeks. So by the time people hear this, it may very well be out and about. Yeah, Tribe of Mentors. Didn't think I'd be doing another book on the heels of the last one, but it's been a very unusual past year for me. Turned 40. Had the 10th anniversary of the 4-hour workweek on the exact day that I got on stage at TED for the first time to talk about my close brush with suicide in college. A bunch of friends have been diagnosed with terminal illnesses or died. It's been a really intense year. And so I think that was the catalyst for a lot of this.
It sounds like it. Yeah. One of the things that, you know, in the beginning of the book, you talk about how you just wanted to, you know, figure out life and wanted to ask the best people and bring the best people to the table to ask these questions to help you figure out life. What is it you're still trying to figure out? What was the goal of the book, I guess, versus like something like Tools of Titans?
Well, Tools of Titans was very much distilled from interviews on the podcast and was intended to be a notebook for myself, in effect, of cliff notes. This time around, I think at various points in life, we reassess, right? So it's not as though there's a huge gaping hole necessarily in our experience of life, although there can be. And perhaps you're content, perhaps you're not, perhaps you're happy, perhaps you're not. But whether it's college graduation or starting your first job, midlife crisis, say a loved one or a parent passing away, there are certain points, getting married or just before you get married, having a kid, there are these many points in life where people tend to step back and reassess and just ask themselves, am I going in the right direction? Or am I just going really fast with a lot of effort in the wrong direction? And
right.
Have I missed a lot in life from being, say, overscheduled or underscheduled for that matter? And these types of reassessments, I think, hit us at multiple points in life. And this last year for me was one of those. But the questions tend to be the same. So for me, as we've certainly talked about separately, I mean, a lot of the work I've done in the last few years, whether it's looking at managing manic depression or looking at psychedelics very in depth and supporting research at places like Johns Hopkins, the recipe, I suppose, that a lot of people use in Silicon Valley or New York or many of the places where I've lived seem to be optimized for, say, incremental financial gain, but they don't seem to make people at the end of the day more fulfilled human beings. I mean, there are exceptions, but I've spent a lot of my life learning how to optimize the math for certain areas that just do not seem to ultimately lead to a sense of peace and well-being in and of themselves, right? So a lot of the questions that I wanted to pose to people around the world, that's another thing. Tools of Titans was very much US-centric. Tribe of Mentors is more global, and the age ranges are much greater. So I'm talking to people in their 20s, but I'm also talking to world champion weightlifters who are, say, in their 60s and 70s and so on. So those are a few of the main differences, I would say.
I'm just curious, when you, because you said it was turning 40 that kind of like kicked this entire process off for you. When you were asking yourself these questions, like, what did you find that you were running in too many different directions, that you were chasing the wrong goals? Like, what was it for you? What did you end up writing down?
I ended up journaling a lot, journaling quite a few things, since I do that more or less every morning with a cup of tea, another one of our shared obsessions. Although you seem to have like hundreds and thousands of pounds of tea that you never consume. So it's more of a,
well, I'm aging it, dude. It's the Pu'er tea.
It's more of a tea museum.
No, you can age that stuff. It's aged like wine. Did you drink through all the tea we got in China?
No, I haven't. I still have a little bit left.
Okay. Yeah, we brought back like, dude, I threw away all my clothes just so I could fill my luggage with tea. We must have brought back hundreds of pounds of tea.
You had some fantastic artwork, if I remember, as well, that you brought back. Yeah. You guys can look up random show China artwork scam and find some good stuff.
Yeah, I got scammed.
But
beautiful stuff
made by students in a basement working for slave labor. Anyway, I think part of the challenge that I have, and a lot of people seem to have these days, is that I don't have one clearly defined job. I have a multi-hyphenate existence, and that has certain freedoms and so on that are fantastic, but it also can lead to me going a million directions at once and making a millimeter of hoped progress in each direction.
Yeah. That's my problem too.
Yeah. It's really awesome and fun to have a lot of side projects. However, if your entire life is side projects, then I think there are inherent risks to that. So for me, I really wanted to talk to people who had achieved greater success in almost any possible metric and also suffered greater hardship in almost any possible way to identify how they think through these things, right? When they hit a crossroads, when they hit a dark period, when they hit a fork in the road that seems huge for them, right? Deciding to, say, get married to someone or end the relationship that they in their heart of hearts to know kind of ended like 3 years before. What do they do? How do they think through it? So on and so forth. So that was really the impetus behind a lot of it. And for me, I think at the very beginning, what I realized when these questions were coming to mind is that there's one question, and I've really made a study of questions in the last few years, in particular with the podcast. There's one question that for me has unlocked the greatest exponential gains in a lot of different areas in my life. And that is, what would it look like if this were easy? And it's such a simple, deceptively leveraged question. I mean, whether it is a relationship, whether it is a business structure, whether it is a trip, you know, what would this look like if it were easy? And I've used that for book writing. I've used it for everything.
Give me an example of that, because I think that on the surface, it sounds Like, what? Give me like a question that you asked yourself, and then how you went in and dug into the details there.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So, for instance, with Tools of Titans, which is, I believe, my best reviewed book to date. I mean, in terms of average customer review, it has the highest review thus far. And when I was writing that book, I asked myself, what would this look like if it were easy? Okay, well, what would easy be characterized by? I would not feel tired. All right, how could I accommodate that? Well, I have to sleep from this point to this point. I would not feel lonely. All right, well, what could I do there? Even if I don't need my researcher at that point to be with me in person, I'm going to fly him from Montreal to Long Island to be with me 24/7. I mean, meaning he's not like babysitting me, but has his own bedroom in my house.
He's your male companion.
He's my male house companion. So, if you guys have seen Birdcage, you know what I'm talking about. So, in the sense that the social component of having someone around so that I didn't feel isolated would be another checkbox. Right. And then I started asking hypotheticals that I knew were exactly that, hypotheticals. For instance, if I only had 1 week to write this entire book, what would I do? Like, if I had a gun to my head and had to do that, what would it look like? And that's all within the subset of what would this look like if it were easy. Okay, let's say that rather than having a longer deadline, I had only 1 week. What would the next three things be that I would do to make this infinitely more efficient than my current plan, right?
So it's more about efficiency than it is about easy. Because you could say, well, the book would write itself, so I should hire a ghostwriter, you know?
No, so that is actually a really important point. Those are also things that I wrote down. So there's, for me, there's the ideation or idea generation phase, and then there's the editing or the selection phase. And those are two very, very, two totally different things, right?
Gotcha. So phase one is just long laundry list. Like, you can say even like, maybe I do hire a ghostwriter. It's just on the list, right?
Exactly. Like, hire a famous editor to be the person who curates A, B, and C, or pay A, B, and C people to go through transcripts and make the following types of selections. And what I ended up doing was then ignoring 90% of that, but taking the 10% that sort of ethically and from a quality assurance standpoint made perfect sense, that would still make it a lot easier, and then implemented those. So Tools of Titans ended up being the second most kind of, I suppose, elegantly constructed book that I've ever written. I mean, Tribe of Mentors would be the first now, because I think I'm getting better at making the process pleasant for myself. But that is how, what would this look like if it were easy, becomes really important. I'll give you another concrete example that is not book related. So I was looking at a potential deal with a large Fortune 500 company that approached me to do some type of partnership. And they have very company favored language, as you would imagine, right? It's like they can terminate for convenience. Sure. I can only terminate for like material breach of contract, right? And then they pay me out in like 117 installments over 97 years, right? Or right. And then the arbitration totally favors them. And if I'm not happy, too bad. They have creative final say. And I was like, all right, well, what would this look like if it were easy? And I just spec'd it out, and then effectively gave it to them and said, hey, look, guys, here are my points. If we're going to do one more round, and that's all I have the bandwidth for, that, which was another piece of the it being easy, like, this will not be a protracted 3 month negotiation. Like, ask for what you want, and then if they can't give it to you, you walk. That's it. And so I told them, I was like, send me next time around, send me, mm-hmm. like, don't send me the dumb guy revision, send me the smart guy revision.
That's hard for those old school in-house councils,
it's,
you know, of these
super
big
hard
corporations that are used to just like pushing their will on others.
Yeah, it's super hard. So this was a litmus test. By that, I mean, when you say, this is what I need, and it's not unreasonable, it's just what I would consider fair. It's like, all right, you guys can terminate for convenience, so can I. Like, if I'm unhappy, this is this. And then to protect my reputation, I need these following creative assurances that are contractually guaranteed. And otherwise, you're asking me to be authentic. That's like the core word in this relationship, the only way I can do that is if I control what I say on some level, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I send that back, what you find out very quickly is, you know, do they want to do business with you? And do you have a champion internally there? Right. Or are they just shopping for a face or a brand name and they are comparing you to seven other people?
Right. Which oftentimes they are. And then you just end up walking.
Yeah, exactly. So what would this look like if it were easy? Number one is making sure that we get to a deal or no deal really, really quickly. So I apply the same type of journaling. And it's not just me sitting down thinking about it. I think that's really, really important. And if you look at, for instance, I was actually amazed in the 130 people or so in Tribe of Mentors, the two most common behaviors were some type of meditation or mindfulness practice.
Mm-hmm. I saw Jimmy Fallon was talking about that on there. I didn't know he was a huge meditator. I knew he dabbled, but it seems like he does that and a lot of walks as well.
Yeah, walks. So it was meditation, walking, and journaling. Those were the three most common.
Crazy.
And the journaling takes all sorts of different forms. And some people are free form. Some people have questions that they ask themselves. A lot of people will take any acute anxiety that they feel and take whatever the big problem is or the macro problem in their head and put it on paper in a very specific way that breaks it down into smaller component pieces. A lot of them do it on airplane rides. Mm. And in my case, there are a few questions that I go to over and over and over again, right? There's the, what would this look like if it were easy? Very closely related to that would be sort of 80-20 analysis, right? So what are the 20% of activities that are giving me 80% of my positive emotional peaks? And then what are the, so the, my wording has changed over time. It used to be income related, right? Mm-hmm. Now it's emotional state related. So what are the 20% of activities and people who are producing 80% or more of my negative emotional peaks, right? Mm. And then I make adjustments based on that. It's been cool to borrow some of the tools and tactics from people in the new book because it's intended to be super hyper practical, right? My answer in writing the book, that's my pet lion. Sorry. That's Molly. That's Molly. Molly, come here, dummy. Molly. Anyway, sorry. We can edit that out or keep it in.
Yeah.
So this is what you get when you take a city dog and move her to Austin where there are wind chimes. She suddenly loses her mind. But what would it look like if it were easier for me in putting this book together, which didn't start as a book. It started with me asking myself all of these life questions was, well, why don't I just send these exact questions to like 150 of the people I don't even think I could get for the podcast and see if I can get them to answer them, which ended up being the case, which was awesome.
Yeah. Who are some of the people that you have in the book that you couldn't get for the podcast? Because I know some of these folks are obviously they're really short on time, so they don't have time to sit down with you for a full blown podcast or maybe don't know you well enough to get on your show. Like who was unexpected that you got for the book?
There were a bunch of really unexpected people. There are the better known names like say Ben Stiller or Patton Oswalt, the comedian. And then there are maybe lesser known names who are well respected in the entrepreneurial business world, like Dustin Moskovitz, co-founder of Facebook. And then you have people who, unlike, say, the last book, which was derived from mostly the podcast, there's some people who are simply better in text. And you know this. Mm-hmm. So you have, say, Temple Grandin. So Temple Grandin is a name that some people will recognize, but she's a very famous animal behaviorist who became famous initially for redesigning slaughterhouses to be more humane. And she has severe autism and is capable of, in effect, thinking like animals. I know it sounds crazy, but she's had a number of books and I've met her once before and it's very difficult to hold a long form conversation because that's not how she's programmed, right? But on a keyboard, her answers are just incredible. And there were a number of scientists, so Nobel level scientists like Lewis Cantley, who's a cancer researcher, who also was a participant in the book. And then other folks, for instance, when I noticed a pattern in the answers, so if say five people recommended a certain book, like Sapiens from Yuval Noah Harari, then I would reach out to the author of that book to try to get them to answer the questions. And this,
oh, very cool.
And that ended up happening. So a bunch of people mentioned him, and he's very hard to get a hold of.
Was that the most recommended book across the board?
That was one of the most recommended. Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl, was another. The Poor Charlie's Almanac by Charlie Munger was another. I think it's The Angels of Our Better Nature. I always misspeak the title of that book by Steven Pinker came up a lot. So I reached out to Steven Pinker at Harvard, who also was able to reply. And it goes on and on. I mean, the equivalent, this woman, Muna Abu Sulaiman, who's been called the Oprah of the Middle East, also replied to the questions. Bollywood actresses who are, and writers who, I mean, I'd never really had any direct contact with before. It's a really wild list. And then you have...
I like that you got Vitalik, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so...
From Ethereum?
Yeah, absolutely. So you have the creator of Ethereum. You have the creator of Zcash. You have other people who many suspect of building other things. And
yeah, we should talk about Nick Szabo.
So cryptocurrency is something I'm interested in. And specifically... you'll notice, Kevin, you may have already noticed this because you're one of like a handful of people on the planet who's actually seen a very early version of the book, is that I wanted to look at how the best of the best think their way through problems and opportunities, right? And what are the industries or professions that represent high-level thinking that can apply other places? And the groups that ended up emerging were... investors. So there are some really incredible investors in this book, including names most people would not recognize unless they're in finance, like the person who was just tapped to lead macro and real estate at Soros's funds, named Adam Fisher. Most people would not know this name, but he is one of the best investors on the planet, period, bar none. To dig into how those people think about opportunities and first principles, and how they use stuff like heart rate variability is very interesting. Very closely related to that is you have the crypto folks, right? So I find...
Wait, one sec before you go into that. The heart rate variability, what are they using that for?
So a lot of these very top finance, I shouldn't say finance, more macro level investors and also talent scouts within the world of finance. So there are a number of people in the hedge fund world use heart rate variability to determine, much like an athlete would, when they are on and when they are off. So if they haven't recovered properly, what they might identify, there are a number of different ways that you can use heart rate variability feedback. You can use it almost like biofeedback in the sense that's existed for decades, that you can then learn to correlate your optimal performance state with a certain type of breathing, right? So if you do, say... Mm-hmm. 20 particular breaths, and it doesn't have to be something like Wim Hof. It could be something much more understated.
Like 4-7-8 or something like that.
Right. So if you're doing like pranayama breathing or whatever the sequence might be, right? Sure. So for those people listening, maybe you say breathe in for a count of 5, inhale for 5, hold for 20, exhale for 10 seconds, something like that. And once you've used the heart rate variability to say, oh, when I do X, my display is such that I know it corresponds to my optimal decision-making state. Right? So I'm making better, say, trading decisions or investment decisions. Conversely, you could say, all right, if I get up in the morning and my heart rate variability, my HRV, which is reasonably easy to track. There are different devices you can wear as rings or bracelets, for instance.
Yeah, I use the Aura ring to track.
So the
mine.
Aura, you and I have talked about this, is a favorite one of the favorites of Dr. Peter Attia, who we both know.
Yeah, he's benchmarked it against a few of them out there.
So if you have that and you wake up and let's say you are a technical trader or you are doing more high frequency placing of bets, for lack of a better, they wouldn't necessarily view it as bets, but let's just call it that for simplicity. If you're in a physiological state that corresponds to your worst decision-making, maybe take the day off. You know what I mean? Or you try to fix it.
Yeah, I use this for my email in the morning. I'm like, oh, shouldn't check email.
Yeah, right.
take the day off.
Or, and it's very similar to how you and I have experimented with ketosis, And there are a number of people in the book who talk about ketosis. And that, in fact, one of the, so there are there are vegans in the book, but there are also people who have followed all meat diets for like 2 years. One of them being Zuko, the creator of Zcash, who's followed an all meat diet for, I think, 2 years now, and has had most of his physical illnesses go away. But
does he get the meat sweats at night? Or anything like that?
Maybe.
You know what I'm talking about? When you eat too much meat, you just sweat like a pig. It's disgusting.
I think it depends on the kind of meat. I don't get the meat sweats. I did get the NAD sweats recently. That's a whole separate story. You and I haven't talked about it. I had 5 days of intravenous NAD treatments.
No way. I've heard about that.
Yeah. One of the more unpleasant things I've ever done. We could talk about that. But
wait, we got to talk about that.
No, we can talk about that. But let me...
Because I've been using that basis supplement to increase my NAD plus
so
levels.
So let me, before we get to that, just to put a period in the thought. So we had investors, very broadly speaking. Then we have crypto blockchain, who tend to be at the top level, very, to use a techie term, orthogonal thinkers, right? They're very good at questioning assumptions, even if it's within the same group of, say, crypto experts, right? Who might in some cases naively assume that all governance or a lot of governance goes completely out the window and there are no historical precedents for what they're doing, which is not entirely true, right? Then you have poker players. So for instance, I dug into Daniel Negreanu. We have Fedor Holtz, and these are just the top of the top of the top. Andy Duke, Liv Borey, these incredible poker players who are extremely good at explaining how they make decisions, not just around the poker table where they've made tens of millions of dollars, but in life in general. And so those are the types of frameworks that I or anyone can use to make better decisions. It's really exciting to me. And then you have the really simple, really, really simple. I think you'll like this one. Sort of heuristics or rules of thumb that you can use for all sorts of things. And one example that comes to mind is from Kyle Maynard. So Kyle Maynard is a congenital quad amputee. That means he was born effectively without arms and legs. Nonetheless, became a highly successful wrestler. I'm not kidding. Also set powerlifting records and has climbed Mount Kilimanjaro without the aid of prosthetics. So did basically a military crawl up all of Kilimanjaro.
Wow.
On top of that, he does quite a lot of business, owns a number of gyms, and does other things. And the advice he was given at one point from one of his business mentors was, if you ask someone to give you an answer, and that could be yourself, like rating something from 1 to 10, like how much would you recommend it to a friend or whatever? Take out 7. So from 1 to 10, what would your answer be? But you can't use a 7 because 7 is kind of a cop out. And when you start to do that, and you have to choose a 6 or an 8, it really tells you how strongly or weakly someone feels about something. That 7 is just, it's the most common answer and it's a very safe answer. And when you start to make decisions for yourself, like how excited am I to do X, Y, and Z deal? 0 to 10, can't use a 7. And you're like, 6. Okay, for me, that's a no-go, right? If it's a hell right. yes or no decision, like Derek Sivers would recommend, then that's a no. If it's an 8, then it's a go. And it makes decision-making a lot easier and a lot faster when you're not allowed to use 7.
Yeah, I love that. You can apply that to anything, like social events that you are asked to attend.
Totally.
You know, all different types of things that we get bombarded with every day.
Yeah, and one of my favorite questions, because I'm actually going through a bit of a funk right now, which you and I could talk about separately, or we could talk about it now, but if you want to psychoanalyze it, but it's, the superheroes, so to speak, that we all or many people put on a pedestal who are on the magazine covers and so on, also have their demons and fight their battles. You just tend not to hear about them. And so the question that I also like to ask people is, do you have a favorite failure? That is a failure or a dark period that set you up for later success? and could you describe it? And so Terry Crews, who gave some of the best answers I've ever seen. I mean, the guy just did a phenomenal, phenomenal job. He was a spectacular athlete for a long period of time and talked about how, you know, a high school loss set him up for believing in himself to the extent that he was able to do a lot of what he did later. And so each of these people, or many of them, have offered dramatic failure stories and described how those have helped them to develop tools or relationships or learn lessons that then help them to have larger successes later. But you mentioned NAD. If you want to talk about it, we can.
Before we get to go to that, I wanted to cover Nick Szabo real quick, since we're not on the same topic anymore because we bounced around like 30 times. But so he was one person in your book that, you know, many people have rumored might be the creator of Bitcoin. It's clear that he played a large role in the creation of BitGold, which was kind of
a precursor
mm-hmm. and a lot of, yeah. So one of the things that Nick said that I thought was just awesome in your book is the question was asked to him, what advice would you give a smart college or driven college student about to enter mm-hmm. the real world? And he said, everyone is striving after social proof, online likes and upvotes. The less you need positive feedback on your ideas, the more original design regions you can explore and the more creative in the long term and useful to society you will be. I thought that was phenomenal.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Just because so many times, like, I've had this in ideas that I've had and I've seen it in others, is you have this kind of like crazy idea that you want to go pursue. And the first thing you do is you go ask all of your friends. And if it truly is unique and original and different, people are going to be like, what the hell are you talking about? You know? And that pushes you back to being just a standard, you know, incremental iteration on something versus having a true novel idea. So I thought that was a great insight.
Oh, absolutely. And what's even cooler about that is that you find similar observations and then recommendations for how to build that tolerance of social rejection or non-acceptance in other people who are in totally different worlds, right? So Darren Aronofsky, who is the director of Black Swan, The Wrestler, most recently Mother, and many others, Requiem for a Dream, would say, in effect, exactly the same thing as Nick did. And both of them have been able to break new ground in part because they really have conditioned themselves or were in some cases born maybe with a high tolerance for social non-acceptance. I think almost anyone in Tribe of Mentors who's operating at a very high level has had to face that, right? What do you do mm-hmm. when you're so far on the edges of ordinary reality that people think your idea is crazy or ridiculous or worthless? Like, how do you respond to that, right? And also, how do you distinguish between good ideas that people aren't ready for and just straight up fucking terrible ideas?
Right.
So you don't want to beat your head against a wall with like the device or the invention or the product that no one needs indefinitely. It's like, look, right. Segway, cool idea, but like you just look like such a super nerd when you're on it. Like it's just not going to catch, you know? And at some point you have to be like, okay, like this is not, we're not going to have tens of thousands of people in cities rolling around on these things. So those are, I think, a lot of the questions that these people grapple with. Scott Belsky, you know, Scott, I mean, he would be another example of that. Like, he's had to make, and he's talked about this, tough decisions where there were products within his company at the time, Behance, which he sold to Adobe for some incredible sum of money, that he mm-hmm. loved, his employees loved, but they were distractions from one or two main focuses that they really had to drill down on if they wanted the company to have any longevity. So they had to kill their darlings, right? So how do you do that? It's mm-hmm. tough. That these are the types of dilemmas, though, that are so cool and useful and sometimes hilarious to read about on paper when you have all these folks.
Yeah. Well, it's just nice to know when you're reading through this book that like other people are struggling with the same things, even though they're insanely successful, like an order of magnitude more successful than you'll ever be. Like they have the same issues that we do, you know?
Oh, totally. And I would say that the word success is a slippery one, right? And that I wouldn't discount readers' abilities to model the people in the book because they're so diverse. I mean, you have people of just about every geographical region, every age bracket, gender, race. Like there's so much variability that I think there are elements from each of these that you can model, because some of them had to basically restart their lives when they were, say, 40 years old, like Jerzy and Aniela Gregorek, who are both multiple-time world record holders in Olympic weightlifting. They came to the U.S. as political refugees from Poland, where they were part of this resistance against totalitarian government. And one of their closest mentors in Poland, who is a priest, was kidnapped, tortured, and killed and thrown into a river, and they had to flee the country. And they came to, ultimately, L.A. with something like $40 and had to sleep on acquaintances' floors to restart their lives. I mean, they had careers, they had networks and everything, and had to restart at a relatively late point, and then have rebuilt themselves into these incredible teachers and performers who now live in Woodside, California, not the most inexpensive place in the world. And they have one of the most beautiful lives I've ever seen. So this is another difference between this book and the last one, is that I'm trying to take, say, in this case, Jerzy and Aniela, husband and wife, so that you can see the perspectives of two people who are effectively on the same path, but very different fundamentally as personalities. So you get very different answers, and you can see that on a principle level, they're on exactly the same page. And that's part of the reason their family and their marriage works so well, but their personalities, their temperaments are so different. I mean, Jerzy is just like hellfire. I mean, the dude is like really, really aggressive and direct. I'll give you one example. When I first met him, because I wanted to work on overhead pressing and overhead squatting and so on. And like, you know me, I'm not a competitive bodybuilder, but I feel like I'm in pretty decent shape. And we sat down on the couch. He always drinks something called Marco Polo black tea. That's the only tea that he drinks. We're sitting down.
What's in that?
It's very similar to, I would say, an Earl Grey tea, but has a much more distinct flavor. It's delicious. You would really like it. Hmm. And
all right,
we're sitting down, first day I've ever met him, and he has a pretty thick Polish accent, but brilliant, brilliant guy. And he looks at me and he's sipping his tea and he's asking me about my goals. And he's kind of looking at me in this vague sense of like disdain is coming across his face. And I'm just like, what's going on? Like, does he have indigestion? What's happening? And then he looks at me and he just reaches across. He's like on the other side of the couch. He reaches across and pinches my tit and goes, "You're too fat." and I was like, Jesus, okay. But I was like, I love this guy. I was like, perfect. Like, in the world of political correctness, to have some guy just reach across, pinch your tit, and be like, "No, you're too fucking fat, Tim. I'm sorry, you're fat. You need to fix this." And I was like, wow, okay, this is the guy I need in my life.
That's awesome.
So anyway, there's a lot of that. But the general categories, I would say, that I wanted to made sure I addressed are similar in the last two books. So in Tribe of Mentors, it would still be sort of healthy, wealthy, wise, right? So you have the business folks, you have the poker folks, but I'm also very interested in people who are professional athletes, right? You have both the female and male winners of the last CrossFit Games are in here. So you have Matt Frazier, you have, I always mix up the Icelandic ladies. What is it with Iceland too? But you have Annie Thor's daughter. That's one. Then Katrin Tanya David's daughter. And tips from all of these people on the physical side of things.
That's awesome.
True also for more recognized athletes like, say, Maria Sharapova, or for those geeks out there who know a lot about powerlifting, Ed Cohn, who's the most successful powerlifter in the history of the sport, also has a lot to say in terms of the physical component. So yeah, it's all over the map. I mean, it's kind of a choose your own adventure guide.
Yeah, I was just going to say that actually. I like the fact that you can just hop around, and I've just been like finding names that I'm like, oh, I wonder what they have to say. And then just like quickly flip there and just read it through. And like, it's, you know, it's really quick. So it's fun like that. So cool. Yeah. Check out Tribe of Mentors. You can pick that up on Amazon. Yeah.
You can pick it up Amazon, anywhere else. If you go to tribeofmentors.com, you can find sample chapters and links to everything as well.
Cool. I want to talk real quick though about your NAD adventures.
My NAD adventures. It's the title of my next children's book. So we could certainly talk
it's
about
so
it.
It's so random that you and I are both doing this at the same time. We didn't even talk about it.
Yeah, small world.
So I've been supplementing, trying to increase my NAD levels. But you just decided to go straight in and just could do intravenous, huh?
Well, I'm doing an experiment, and I should just say, for both of us, we're not doctors. We don't play them on the internet. So get proper medical advice, particularly if you're looking at anything like intravenous treatments. I did a loading phase of 5 days of intravenous NAD plus a few other infused vitamins and elements in the cocktail, which was one of the more unpleasant things I've done in recent memory. When I was getting, and everybody had these symptoms, it was a question of severity. But when you receive, at least in my experience so far, and I was sitting with 3 to 5 very high level athletes, former professional athletes, and you feel intense nausea and abdominal cramping, like your organs are cramping. It's not a stomach cramp feeling.
Well, tell people why you're doing this to begin with. Like, what is this? Why does it decline with age, and why were you supplementing it?
Why don't you start? And then I'll cover some of the gaps.
Yeah. So basically, from what I understand, you have this compound in your body, and it declines with age. Meaning, you know, we're in our 40s now, so we have less of it than we did, say, in our 30s or 20s. And from what I've read online, there is ways to increase that naturally through supplementation or through intravenous, like straight into the body. And the benefits that I've seen, the majority of benefits, if you look at all the different supplements that are out there, and you read all of the, you know, hundreds of comments on Amazon, tend to be pretty wide ranging. But I say number one is energy. And then I've even seen people say like things like wrinkles in their skin diminishing and some of their hair that was gray starting to go back to normal color. I don't know how much of that is BS, but I definitely, the number one theme is that your just energy levels go back to like they were, say, in your 20s or teens.
Right. So there's a lot of nonsense and charlatanism related to an NAD online and certainly offline. So I'm still optimistically skeptical, I would say, at this point. The supplement you mentioned, Basis, is of interest to me. My understanding, although I think this could actually be inaccurate, is on my part, is that their ingredients are precursors, which are then converted to NAD.
That's right.
Preferentially by the body. What I was doing for the last 5 days, and then I am going to maintain for a period of time, NAD supplementation orally, but I was receiving 750 milligrams, I believe it was 750 milligrams of NAD mixed into saline solution with a handful of other things over the course of, say, anywhere between 30 minutes and 2 hours, depending on how well you can tolerate the side effects. And the objective, to come back to that, would be one part simply to observe what the effects are, because as you noted, there are all these anecdotal reports of, and there are clinical studies that have looked at NAD as well. But if you look at the anecdotal human reports, they tend to focus on increased energy, which is extremely fungible. And there are many things that could account for it. So I think a very high percentage of the people taking NAD are very often non-athletes who are taking it for longevity purposes, who do not have a lot of experience taking supplements. So I would say that they may be more prone to placebo effect than someone who's swallowed, this is not necessarily a good thing, but probably tens of thousands of capsules, right? Like, I've tried a lot of stuff. It's just absurd. So my hope would be, based on the feedback I heard also from former professional athletes who have used intravenous treatment, is improved athletic performance, specifically, say, aerobic capacity at a lower heart rate that would be reflective of improved mitochondrial function or something like that. And I based on the reading I've done and the personal experiences I've had with, say, Lyme disease, there are most likely issues with my mitochondria that have been exacerbated by things like Lyme disease. And the prospect of, say, repairing that or even masking the symptoms of that for a short period of time are interesting to me. So I had I had the 5 days of the intravenous, and then I went to the gym after 5 days, and I was like, oh man, this is going to be awesome. I'm going to be like Ronnie Coleman. I'm just going to lift the squat rack with the weight on it and do bench press with it. It's going to be amazing. And I went in and had one of the shittiest workouts I've ever had.
Oh, really?
That's after 5 days. So I don't know what the lag time is. If there is a lag time, I don't know if it was simply an off day because perhaps 2 days earlier I didn't get enough sleep. Who knows, right? But the jury's still out as far as I'm concerned, personally, from an empirical standpoint. So I will keep taking it and for a short period of time and see how it does.
So my experience has been that, at least for me personally, I've always had this issue that around 3 o'clock or so, I'm like, okay, time for a cup of coffee or something that like just needs to kind of jolt me up a little bit to like get me through the rest of the day. And I will say it's been about a month and a half now that I've been taking this. It's not, go flying out of the house, like bounding with like just limitless energy. I'm not getting that, but I don't have that slump anymore. And when I do my Peloton now, when I do my bike rides, I have done several 75-minute rides now that I just don't tire. I just like fire it up 75 minutes and I just go in the afternoon and I'm like drenched in sweat, burn, over 1,000 calories. And I'm like, wow, like I can't really say that was the case a couple months ago.
Yeah. So I should point out that this is actually an important distinction. So the workout I was doing yesterday was all heavy resistance training. So it could be that it has
more of a cardio benefit versus
exactly. The athletes from whom I heard the positive feedback were all high level endurance athletes, not power athletes. So that could be the primary distinction. And I'm actually going to do some cycling workout most likely later today. So I'll have another data point, sort of 24 hours post my last IV to see what type of improvement, if any, can be measured. And the cycling is nice, say on a Peloton, because you have a record of your wattage and everything else so that you can really compare apples to apples.
That's right.
Which is nice. Important to do the workout at the same time of day, though, if you're comparing the workouts, since pain tolerance and other things tend to fluctuate quite a bit during the day. So I will be comparing those. But yeah, I'm dialing back on a lot of supplement stuff, man.
Yeah, let's cover that real quick, because you're the king of this, having done tens of thousands of capsules down your throat. what do you take these days? Are you doing omega-3s, multis, vitamin D, like any of that? What's your regimen look like?
So I take, let's see, for me, this would be very little, which is like laughable for most people who are going to hear this. But I generally take creatine and ubiquinol together, and that is primarily in the hopes that it would stave off neurodegenerative decline, since I have Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and so on both sides of my family.
How many, just like a gram or two of creatine?
It's not very much. I'm not doing any type of loading dosage or anything like that. It's a lower
for maintenance stuff.
Yeah, it's a lower amount. I would have to go look at the bottle specs, but it's something along those lines. Then
with the ubiquinol, are you combining PQQ or no?
I'm not combining PQQ right now, just because I'm not totally convinced that it's going to move the needle. But at the end of the day, who knows? The information that we have is so incomplete. But for the time being, I'm taking creatine and ubiquinol. Then I am taking fish oil or krill oil. Mm-hmm. Krill, subjectively for me, seems to decrease inflammation more so than an equivalent amount of omega-3, for instance. I get my fish oil through ingesting sardines. I mean, I have these Wild Planet or canned sardines every morning or every other morning, just like Dominic D'Agostino, who is this incredible beast of a scientist/athlete that people can look up.
How do you eat your sardines? Are you just like pulling them out and just like straight down the throat?
Hobo style, like over the sink, out of the can with a fork.
Does Molly get to have some of those?
Molly gets to have the fishy oil. So I don't just like drink the sardine drenched olive oil. I used to, and it was just too much. So I don't do that. I eat the sardines and then I drizzle the oil over Molly. That's my dog's food, which of course is just like crack to her. So she's a big fan. Yeah. She's a big fan. The other supplements that I take, I do take a green supplement. I take athletic greens, which I've used for years. As a general insurance policy, just to cover my bases. And if I'm doing training, I will take supplemental protein. I use something called Ascent protein plus collagen. I'll add in some collagen as well. Then in terms of capsules and so on, there are actually a few products that I picked up from recommendations from people in Tribe of Mentors, actually. One of my favorite things is being able to try all these products that people recommend before they get sold out on Amazon and everywhere else. Because one of the questions I ask everybody is, what is the purchase of less than $100 that has most improved your life in the last, say, year or 5 years? And so I go out and I buy all that stuff because I know that there's going to be a huge run and I'm going to give the hug of death to like half of these companies, right?
Well, give me a couple of your favorites.
Oh man, let me, I'd have to walk over. There is a mushroom based immunity product.
Oh, that was the first person I remember. It's a myo...
something or other. Myco something, something or other.
Stapens out of Washington. He's the guy that wrote the book on mushrooms. He's great.
So
I've used that product for years, by the way.
So I've found that to seemingly make a difference, even in the past few months of traveling where immune function is so often compromised. I've been taking that. Then I do take... And I'm not sure you and I have talked about this. I think we might have, but low-dose lithium orotate. So I take 5 milligrams of lithium orotate.
Oh, yeah, dude. I was telling you about that. Remember back in the day?
The same person told both of us about it.
Oh, really? Who was
Atiyah.
It? Oh, was
it was Atiyah. So we both have experimented with the low-dose lithium orotate, which I still do take, and I cycle off of it. For those people interested in learning more about why, you could look up New York Times, and I think the title is Maybe We All Just Need a Little Bit of Lithium.
That's right. Great article.
And certainly at higher doses, you need to speak to your medical professional, but we're talking about 5 milligrams versus, say, 1,200 to 1,500 milligrams for treating, say, bipolar as a monotherapy. So low-dose lithium orotate plus NAC. So
I do even lower dose than that, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Because I get it in liquid form, and I do a dropper. So I'll just do like a couple drops on my tongue every day.
Is this more of your dark web antics?
No. So, well, here's the deal. I looked at the studies, and if you take a look at, so one of the things that's really interesting about the article is they talk about places where lithium is naturally found in the drinking water has lower rates of suicide. Right. And so I looked at those studies, and it's actually a lot lower dose than 5 grams.
Milligrams.
Sorry, 5 milligrams. God, we're going to kill people.
Never, ever take 5 grams of lithium, people, please.
So actually something really interesting you might like, there is a water that I found that you can get at Whole Foods or any grocery store or the fancier grocery stores. It's out of Germany, And it's called, I'm going to butcher this name, but it's Gerolsteiner. Gerolsteiner.
The carbonated water.
Yeah, the carbonated water. Yeah, so it tastes fantastic. It's great water. But I went online, and if you take a look at the back of the label, it says calcium, magnesium, all that good stuff, right? But of course, they're not going to say lithium on the back of the label. But it says other dissolved solids, right? So I'm like, I wonder what else is in here. So I went to the website, pulled up the actual ingredients, and it does have the accurate microdose of lithium that you would need, right? Just built into this drinking water, the sparkling water that you can get at Whole Foods. So you could just buy this water and have one a day, which is great.
You know, that could explain something, because I've had, for the first time actually, Gerolsteiner water in my fridge, which I've been drinking. And maybe I'm just doubling up on my lithium. So I need to be careful. That's why supplements are so dangerous, kids out there.
It's a small amount, though. No, it's a little microdose. It'll be fine.
But that's good to know. Yeah, so the Gerolsteiner is very moderately carbonated, for people wondering. It's less carbonated than, say, a San Pellegrino or a Topo Chico or something like that. Certainly a Topo Chico.
I love Topo Chico.
It's good stuff. They just got bought by Coca-Cola, which I think I have mixed feelings about. But the NAC is the other one that I take on a daily basis.
And what's that for?
So NAC, N-acetylcysteine, is a precursor to glutathione, which is thought of as an antioxidant. And I began taking NAC for athletic recovery. And what I noticed is maybe a week later after starting NAC that I felt much more even keeled. I was less prone. I've never really been prone to manic episodes, but I have gone into lower lethargic periods. And I just noticed that my temperament and my patience, everything was much more even keeled for a week or two. Hmm. And I couldn't figure out why, but it was so consistent that I looked at the supplements that I'd added to my routine and went on PubMed and started to look at studies to see what might be causal or have some impact. And it turned out that NAC also, in some studies, has been demonstrated to have an impact on bipolar depression. And I was like, oh, shit. That's amazing. Okay, well, let me just keep that in the rotation then. So NAC, lithium, that's really about it. I'm trying to get as much from Whole Foods as possible. I think that our assumption that underlies many supplements, which is we know what foods are made of, and we can therefore isolate the things that are good, take out the things that are bad, and prescribe sniper-like accuracy specific compounds that you can just take as supplements to avoid the inconvenience of food, I think is very, as Nassim Taleb wrote The Black Swan, would say, epistemologically arrogant. I don't think we are even close to understanding.
Well, we've been screwed by it a few times now. Like, if you remember back in the 90s when beta-carotene was like all the rage. Yeah. And then everyone's like supplementing high dose beta carotene. And then all of a sudden we're like, oh shit, unless you do mixed carotenes, all the other carotenes in the family, like beta will give you cancer.
Yeah.
And it's like, oops. We didn't know that because we isolated it.
You know? That's also part of the reason I'm so conservative about exogenous ketones. So I will use, in other words, supplemental ketones, which have become all the rage, or
what brand do you use?
Before I get to that, let me give the warning. Because people will be like, sweet, and jump on Amazon and buy it before they even listen to the rest of it. So I will answer that. But there seem to be new companies, new products coming out every week to add complexity and problems to the whole situation. A lot of them are MLM or network marketing companies. Just spins out of control. Sorry, I've been cursing. You're not cursing. So it makes me think maybe this is family programming.
Right. No, it's okay. We say shit.
Good work. You sounded like Matt Mullenweg trying to curse there for a second. Anyway, for those who know what that means, you'll get it. All right. So my concern is that if you are not in the transition to ketosis or in ketosis and you're using exogenous ketones, which can bump your millimolar reading of BHB in the blood, if you're using, say, a precision extra measurement device up to like 3 millimolars or more in some cases, like 30 minutes later, you have a couple tablespoons of this stuff. If you're doing that while you're still consuming carbohydrates, I am concerned that that is going to produce long-term health problems, because to a amateur scientist like myself, so I'm sure I'm missing something obvious, the only place that combination is exhibited in nature that I'm aware of in humans is in ketoacidosis for type 1 diabetics, which is a very dangerous condition where they have elevated blood glucose and they have elevated ketone levels.
Right. So you're double dipping, essentially. You're getting energy from two sources.
From a physiological standpoint, isn't really going to happen, right? By the time you get into deep ketosis, your glycogen stores will be so depleted that you're not going to have elevated glucose.
Right.
So it's a very unusual, unnatural state in a lot of respects if people are consuming carbohydrates. Okay. So what's happening, and you see this online, is people say, oh, well, I'm too lazy to go on a ketogenic diet, but I can get the benefits of ketones just by like having some ketone esters with my bulletproof coffee in the morning, and then I can have my bagel at lunch or whatever. And it's like, oh,
so interesting. So let me ask you a question. Do you think then that, so let's say, for example, you do supplemental ketones and you have elevated blood glucose, are your glucose levels not coming down because you're not tapping those stores then? So you're keeping that pegged higher?
I don't know. Short answer to that is I don't know.
Because that would be scary, right? Like keeping that glucose in your blood pegged at a higher level.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question for one of our doctor friends. But I don't know. It's entirely conceivable to me, and I think the I don't know piece is why I'm very conservative.
Okay, so what you're doing then is you're saying, okay, I'm going to get into a mild form of ketosis. Let's just say 1.5 millimolars, and then you say, okay, now I can do a tiny little bit of like, how's your father on top of that? Like a little bit of like a little floater, yeah, on top to like boost things
little,
up.
Little tickle, a little
tickle of ketones.
A little tickle. That's basically what I'm saying. Although I would use it even if I am in the transition to say 1.5. You seem to have cellular machinery that helps you to get into ketosis a bit faster than, or a more,
thank you.
You're welcome. Or more deeply in an equivalent period of time than myself. It takes me a while, but I would say if I'm using, say, a day of fasting and moderate walking and a handful of other tricks to get into ketosis as quickly as possible, I would also use a little bit of exogenous ketones to smooth the transition so that I'm not totally brain dead for three.
Right. It gets that keto fog or whatever.
Exactly. Exactly. I don't get the keto flu symptoms that some people do, as they call it, but the keto fog I will definitely get. And depending on my situation, that may or may not be a good idea. So I will very intermittently use it as the transition into ketosis, and then sometimes as a bumper if I'm already in ketosis and say going into a workout that's primarily aerobic, then I might gun the system a little bit with exogenous ketones. And
so what brand do you use?
I like Keto Blitz, which is from Keto Sports. That is what I've had the best results with, but it appears, at least at the time I checked a few days ago, sold out. So I know the person who makes it, Patrick Arnold, who also, for those people wondering, was the black market biochemist behind Barry Bonds and Marion Jones and all those folks.
Amazing.
So he knows his stuff. I believe they should have supplies back in stock soon. But yeah, Keto Blitz would be my general go-to. There are others, certainly, that tend to, if it has to taste good in powder form, usually there's a bunch of other crap in there that I would prefer not to have in there.
A lot of stevia.
Yeah.
Like a ton. Yeah. I can't take it. It's like
cloyingly sweet. Yeah. And the artificial sweeteners too, I think there is some, there are some data to suggest that it's insulinogenic, even though it's non-caloric in many cases. Mm-hmm. So I don't want that stuff in my system, especially if I'm trying to get into ketosis. So I will generally go with Keto Blitz, which is, it doesn't taste terrible, but it's certainly not intended to be an orange creamsicle smoothie either.
Yeah.
So yeah.
All right.
Well, I know we both got, we've been all over the place in this podcast, as per usual, any random show that we do. Dude, Tim, thank you so much for being on my show finally. And definitely check out Tribe of Mentors, which is should be out now.
Yeah, should be available everywhere. People can check out free chapters, see the names of the guests and everything at tribeofmentors.com, or they can jump to Amazon or wherever they like to buy books, whatever fine retailer they like to visit on their off time.
Awesome. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Kev.
That is it for this episode. If you have listened this far, I hope you enjoyed it. And the one ask favor that I'll ask of you would be to head on over to iTunes, search for The Kevin Rose Show, and give us a 5-star review if you believe I deserve it. If not, email me, reply to my journal newsletter, and tell me what I can do to improve the show. But a 5-star review will really help increase the recommendation of this podcast. So it'll get recommended throughout the iTunes universe a lot more frequently, which will mean in turn more downloads and better guests for the show. So that is it. Be well.